Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, billionaire businessman David Rubenstein, the son of a Baltimore postal worker. Rubenstein has been a fixture in Washington for decades as a private lawyer, a presidential advisor, and eventually co-founder of the Carlyle Group, one of the largest private equity firms in the world. Recently, Rubenstein has dedicated his attention and money to preserving the history of the country he says allowed him to live the American dream. He's purchased copies of documents like the Declaration of Independence and put them on public display. And he's paid for the restoration of memorials and monuments. Another effort, history lessons for America's lawmakers. Now we can all find them in a new book, The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians. David Rubenstein, how great to have you here again.
My pleasure to be here.
Tell me about these conversations you've had with master historians.
I thought it would be a good idea to have a program to educate members of Congress a little bit more about history than they might already be educated. They actually know a fair bit about it, but learning more wouldn't hurt. So about 6 years ago, I went to the Library of Congress, Jim Billington, and said, why don't we have a program that I'll underwrite at the Library of Congress where we'll bring members of Congress together for a reception, then a dinner, and I'll interview a great American historian, David McCullough, Doris Kearns Goodwin, or equivalent. And he said, okay, and we tried it, and members turned out to love it because it's a place where they can go that's nonpartisan. There's no press there, so they don't feel they're constrained in saying hello to a person of the opposite party. They don't really know people from the opposite house that much anymore because they don't really do legislation. So there's no conference committees. So the House members don't know Senate members that much anymore. So this is a chance for people from the different houses to come together and different parties to come together. And then I do an interview for about 45 minutes, and then members ask questions as well. So that's what it has been. I've done about almost 50 of them now.
And how many members of Congress ordinarily show up?
It's more than I would have thought. We get about 300 to 325 people. Each member can bring a guest. So I would guess it's probably about 150 to 175 members coming. Some people draw more than others. When we had the Chief Justice, he was a gigantic draw. David McCullough is a big draw, of course, all the time. But some of the authors that are not as well known still are pretty big draws in some cases. So it's worked out quite well. And it's something I'm quite proud of because I feel it's my little contribution to having members get to know each other and maybe the era of good feelings, while it hasn't broken out exactly, it's a little bit better, at least during that period of time. I analogize it to this situation. During the Civil War, Confederate troops and Union troops, they had an agreement that if they ever got on the grounds of Mount Vernon, it was sacred territory because it was George Washington's home. So they would stop fighting there and they would just be civil to each other. The same thing is here. When they go to these Library of Congress dinners, there's no political bickering. People that you see on TV fighting with each other, they're actually sitting next to each other and having a nice dinner.
I must say, I think it's a great idea. The one thing I must tell you is that I've learned through this book as much from your questions as I have from the answers. You clearly know your stuff.
Well, you have read the book, and so it's a courtesy to me that you've read the book. I feel it's a courtesy when you're interviewing an author to have read the book.
Absolutely.
And so I always read the books. And so some of the books are 800 pages, and I'm racing to get them done. Some are shorter. The book author has spent typically a year or 10 years on a book.
Of course.
And if you've spent 10 years on the book, you can spend 10 hours talking about it. But I only have 45 minutes. So I kind of know how to get the person through the beginning to the end, and I try to take the person through the trajectory of the book in 45 minutes if possible.
I'm not going to ask you to recite from memory, but I was so impressed with the comments of George Washington when he talked about the high ideals of the Revolution. Talk about that.
George Washington was the indispensable man. He didn't really want to be the Revolutionary War general. He didn't really want to leave Mount Vernon. He did for the country that he was helping to form. He didn't really want to preside over the Constitutional Convention, but he was importuned to do so by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, so he did so. And he didn't really want to be president for one term, let alone two terms. But he did these things, and each time he retired back to Mount Vernon. When he gave up power after the Revolutionary War, King George said, if that's true, he's the greatest man in the world, because usually people would win wars as generals, stay and they run a country. He didn't want that. George Washington was not an educated man. He didn't go to college or anything like that, like some of the founding fathers, but he was actually pretty smart, and his letters are pretty well written, I think. But interestingly, he didn't feel as comfortable writing things sometimes as some of the people that were, quote, better educated. So when he was president of the United States, he might say, I want to send a message to Congress. He'd ask James Madison, a member of Congress, to write it. Then the Congress would say, we have to respond. So James Madison would write the response. Then Washington would respond to Congress, and James Madison would write that as well. So Washington knew how to use very good ghostwriters.
But he said, it is yet to be decided whether the revolution must ultimately be considered as a blessing or a curse, not to the present age alone, for with our fate will the destiny of unborn millions be involved.
I think that George Washington was a British citizen in his view when he was growing up. His brother had worked in the British military, and George Washington, as a young man, actually wanted to get a commission in the British military. He didn't quite get that, but he was somebody that really was fond of the British, because that's what he was. All the colonial leaders in the time were British citizens when they were growing up, and so you think about it, for somebody that's very wealthy as he was and very established to say, "I'm going to break against my country and create and lead a revolution." It was treason in the view of people in Britain. So it took a lot of courage to do that.
Where was he ultimately buried?
Well, when George Washington died, and he died in a very unusual way, you might say, he was riding around on his horseback, came back. He was dripping wet. It was been snowing and sleeting. He had guests there. He didn't want to be impolite and go up and say, let me change. I'll be back in an hour. So he sat there a little bit wet. Not a brilliant thing to do. That night, the epiglottis in the back of his throat swelled up. He called the doctor. The doctor said, I don't think a tracheotomy will work, but if we cut the veins and let the bad spirits out, you'll be okay. And George Washington agreed with that. So he did, and obviously he went into shock and he died. When he died, they opened his will, and two very unusual things were in their will. One, he said, I want to free my slaves, which is the only founding father who freed his slaves. However, he said, upon the death of my wife. So how would you like to be Martha Washington sitting around there knowing that all these slaves know they're going to be freed as soon as you die? So she freed a lot of them quickly. Secondly, he said, don't bury me for 2 days. Why? Because he was afraid about being buried alive.
How many people were buried alive in those days?
I don't know, but the doctors weren't very good, to be honest, and there weren't that many doctors floating around. So sometimes if people just seemed like they were dead, they put them in a coffin. So that's why they put bells in the coffin, and you were supposed to ring the bell if you got awake before you were put underground. That's where the phrase dead ringer comes from. George Washington, when he did die, it was ultimately decided that he would be buried on the grounds of Mount Vernon. There was a proposal at the time to be buried up on Capitol Hill. Because when he died, John Adams was president, it was there was a lot of political fighting between the so-called Republicans, which were Jefferson and Madison, and the Federalists, which was John Adams. And because of that politics, they didn't want to honor George Washington by putting him on the Capitol because he was a Federalist and it would be seen as not a good thing by the Republicans. So they didn't bury him on Capitol Hill then. Later, when they got around to building the Washington Monument, it was thought maybe it'd be a good idea to bury him there. But in the end, it was decided that he should stay at Mount Vernon. That's where he is.
I gather the first interview you did for this series was with John Meacham.
That's correct. I had the good fortune of having John Meacham, who has become a good friend, and he came and he did an interview, and he's a compelling storyteller.
Yes.
And I should say, it's one thing to write a great book, as some of these authors do. It's another thing to be good in talking about the book. Some people are better raconteurs about what they've written than others. And I think John is a terrific one. I had the good fortune of interviewing many great raconteurs about their books. Doris Kearns Goodwin, David McCullough, Scott Berg. They really are good at talking about their book as well as writing a good book.
I want to now move forward to a time when I was alive and Jay Winnick's book on Hitler and the Second World War. You describe, or he describes, Hitler at the end of his life. I was surprised at that.
Well, Hitler was taking a lot of narcotics to keep himself alive, stimulants and other things, and he didn't really realize until the very end that it wasn't going to work. And so in the end, of course, he took his life. But there was a lot of dispute over the years whether he actually died or not. I think there's evidence now that the Russians really had his body or parts of it. And so he of course, did die by suicide, as did his wife of one day, Eva Braun. Interestingly, in the book by Jay Winnick, which is called 1944, he does one of the best jobs I've ever seen of describing how the United States knew about the Holocaust going on, but chose not to do anything about it. Generally, it was felt by the State Department that this wasn't something that was the war mission. The military thought it would be too risky, apparently, to bomb the railroad tracks going to Auschwitz. So President Roosevelt was told about this, and Henry Morgenthau, a Jewish Secretary of Treasury, who was the only person Jewish in the cabinet and one of the most prominent Jewish members of society in that day, he was a friend of Roosevelt's. He was reluctant to talk to him about it, but ultimately he did. But Roosevelt did nothing about it, and we don't know exactly the reason. Maybe the State Department just told him it was too difficult to get this done. So it's sad. Many people died who might have been saved.
Indeed, and didn't Eleanor Roosevelt have a certain amount to do with persuading her husband?
Eleanor Roosevelt was influential. It was a complicated marriage, as we all know.
Yes.
But they lived in separate rooms in the White House, and they had many people living in the White House as well. Doris Kearns Goodwin, in one of her books, talked about how they had, at the residence of the White House, you had Harry Hopkins, one of Roosevelt's aides, Eleanor Hickok, a friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's, living there. It was kind of a menagerie of people living at the second floor of the White House. Winston Churchill would come over, and he'd be staying there for a while, and sometimes be walking around naked. And ultimately, they bought Blair House to keep him from staying at the White House.
When I referred to Hitler, Jay Winnick mentions Parkinson's disease.
He had Parkinson's, it appears. He had many different diseases. We don't know for certain all of the diseases. So he was highly medicated. I don't think we fully know all the medications he had. But, the war could have turned out differently. For example, when the D-Day invasion occurred, Hitler was sleeping, and his generals were afraid of waking him up. And so the panzer divisions that were available to go fight the Americans and the British at Normandy, they weren't alerted to do so for many, many hours because they didn't want to wake up Hitler when he was sleeping. Had those troops been put there, maybe D-Day would have turned around and been different, and maybe the war would have gone differently.
But Jay Winnick talks about the fact that it took so long after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor for D-Day to actually come.
The United States today, we look at the war differently. The United States did not want to go into the war. Many people thought it was terrible. Charles Lindbergh, among others, led an effort to be, quote, America first. We didn't want to get into another European war. We'd been in the First World War. So Churchill came to see Roosevelt several times and said, can you get in the war? Can you help us? And in the end, they came up with Lend-Lease, which was a way to get military equipment to the British, but no troops. After Pearl Harbor, amazingly, after the Japanese bombed us, Germany declared war on us too. I don't know why they had to, but they did. Had they not declared war on us, we might have gone to war as well, certainly against the Japanese. Whether we've gone to war against the Europeans is not quite clear. We didn't have a military machine. We had let it go down a bit after World War I, so we didn't have the military armaments and everything ready to go. So it took us a number of years. The Pearl Harbor occurred on December the 7th, 1941. D-Day didn't occur until June 6, 1944, 3 years later, more or less. And in part, we weren't ready. In fact, Churchill was interested in our having a D-Day invasion about a year earlier, and the Americans really weren't ready. We didn't have anybody we thought who could lead it, and they wanted to give Eisenhower, who was likely to lead it, some more military experience commanding troops. So they ultimately let him command an invasion of Italy and invasion of Africa to give him more experience and ultimately be ready to lead the D-Day invasion. But it wasn't clear that the D-Day invasion would succeed. Today, we now think it was a great victory. But remember, Eisenhower had prepared a statement saying, I'm sorry, it didn't work out. And in fact, if the Panzer troops had gone there, we might not have succeeded.
There's always been this discussion, I don't know whether to call it a question or not, as to whether Roosevelt actually knew before the bombing of Pearl Harbor that it was going to take place.
There are many conspiracy theories today on things, and there were many conspiracy theories then. There were people who thought, how could he not know? And in fact, he wanted us to get into the war, so he kind of said, well, maybe I'll let the bombing occur, and therefore it'll propel us to go into war, because who could not want to go into war then? I don't really believe there is strong documentary evidence that that he knew. There was no doubt that some of our military people had thought that maybe Pearl Harbor would be a good target to attack. And there's no doubt that some people suspected an attack like that would occur, and some people predicted it. But knowing that that was going to happen that way on December the 7th, I don't believe that was true. I don't think there's documentary evidence that indicates it.
What do you suppose keeps those questions and conspiracy theories alive?
Some people like conspiracies. They believe that there is always a reason to explain something that is consistent with your life experience and your worldview that is inconsistent with what other people say. So, you know, lots of people love conspiracy theories. There are lots of conspiracy theories about John Kennedy, who really killed him, Abraham Lincoln, who really killed him. Whenever you have murders, you have conspiracy theories. I think whenever you have tragedies, you have conspiracy theories, or conspiracy theories about 9/11, conspiracy theories about Pearl Harbor. In the end, I think an informed person has to make his or her best judgment. But in my best judgment, I don't believe that Roosevelt knew in advance that there was going to be an attack that day. The overwhelming body of evidence is that Roosevelt may have had suspicion that the attack would occur at some point. Where, we didn't know. When he didn't know. I do not in any way believe that he knew that that attack was going to occur on that day and that devastating level.
Of course, the marshaling of manufacturing that went on to create the armaments that the U.S. was able to use, that was an extraordinary effort.
For people my age, I was born in 1949. It's hard for me to understand how the country was so united in the war effort, because in Vietnam War and other wars we've had in my lifetime, the country was divided. In that day, there weren't a lot of people saying, hey, I don't think I'll go into the military. Hey, I think I'll just stay in school instead. Or I don't really care about this war in Europe. That's somebody else's business. Once Pearl Harbor occurred, the United States was united. I would suspect 98% of the Americans were united in supporting that war effort. And those who didn't live during that time just can't really appreciate how united the United States people were in that war effort. And many things that Americans took as necessary for their day-to-day life were taken away in many ways. And there was food rationing. There was gasoline rationing. The country was, went through that for 4 years or so. And after it was over, the United States emerged relatively prosperous. The rest of the world was not that prosperous. After World War II, the United States was roughly 50% of the world's GDP, 50%. Today, we're probably 18% or so. So we were half the world's economy because Europe had been decimated. That's why the Marshall Plan had to come about. The United States, while we put a lot of effort into the war effort, we didn't have the devastation that they had in Europe.
The United States at that point was such a prominent source with the Marshall Plan, with the liberation of France, with so much that America did, our standing has dropped so much.
George Marshall had been the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and many people thought he was going to be the head of the D-Day invasion, and that was, he was being prepared for it. And then Roosevelt asked him if he wanted to do it, and Marshall said, well, it's up to you. And Roosevelt, in the end, chose Eisenhower, because Eisenhower was very much liked by Winston Churchill, among other things, but he also wanted to keep Marshall with him. Marshall subsequently became Secretary of State under Harry Truman, and as Secretary of State, he made a famous commencement speech at Harvard where he announced a plan, now called the Marshall Plan, to rebuild Europe. And so Europe was rebuilt, but it took many, many years to rebuild Europe. It cost a lot of money for American taxpayers to do it, but everybody believes it was well worth it.
Now a quick break. When we come back, more from David Rubenstein.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now here's the rest of my conversation with David Rubenstein. His new book is titled The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians. Of course, then came Ike to the presidency and the national highway system, which was his grand idea.
Yes, let me explain that. Eisenhower, because he had won the war through D-Day, he was a hero. Getting ready for the 1948 election campaign, Harry Truman said, "I'll get you the Democratic nomination, you run as a Democrat." And Eisenhower had never said he was a Democrat or Republican, but he turned it down. And then Truman later turned on him. When Eisenhower announced he was a Republican, he got the nomination in 52 and in 56 and won handily. The idea for the interstate highway system today seems obvious. Why would you not have an interstate highway system? But we didn't have one. Now, where did Eisenhower get the idea for it? Well, when he was in the military in World War I, he was asked to drive some caravan across the United States to see how long it would take and what it was like. And he did it, and he realized it would take a couple weeks, and the system was bad. So he stored that in the back of his brain, and ultimately he came up with the idea, along with advisors, the interstate highway system. And interestingly, we did it with off budget. It was not it didn't cost any money to the taxpayers in that sense, because it was all funded through gasoline taxes, in effect.
You actually worked in the government yourself. You worked for Jimmy Carter. How do you see his presidency now?
Well, Stuart Eisenstadt, my former boss, I was his deputy during the Carter years, has written a definitive book, about 900 pages, on Jimmy Carter's presidency. And when you read that book, you realize just how much Carter was doing and tried to get done and actually got done. Because he lost decisively to Ronald Reagan, we saw his presidency as being a failed presidency. In our country, if you don't get reelected, you're a failed president. So Gerald Ford failed. George H.W. Bush failed. Jimmy Carter failed. But in truth, Carter did get a lot done. He made some mistakes. His ex-presidency or post-presidency is now 10 times as long as his presidency. So he's out of office 40 years. He was in office only 4 years. So in that period of time, he's accomplished an enormous amount and become a role model for people, because people who leave the presidency, particularly people who leave at a young age like Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, they want to do things that are great the rest of their lives. They don't want to just sit around and say, "I was president." So I think Carter's done a terrific job in many respects, and he's now 95 years old. He's overcome lots of ailments, as you know. He had cancer, beat that. He's broken some bones recently. But at 95, he's terrific. And I did a Skype interview of him not long ago with Stuart Eisenstadt, and his mind is so sharp still.
I know it.
So I said to him, "President Carter, when you had your first debate in 1976 with Gerald Ford, first presidential debate since 1960, the electricity went out and everything stopped for about 18 minutes or whatever it was. How come you never went over to talk to Gerald Ford? He didn't come over to you." And we talked about it. And I said, in the context of that, that was the first of the four debates in 1976. And he said, "David, there were only three debates, not four. Why did you say four?" He was right. I was wrong. I thought there were four debates. There were three. He's picked that up, and that was 40-some years ago.
What do you think about Michael Bloomberg getting into the Democratic race?
I should disclose that I have a television show that's on the Bloomberg TV network, so I'm partial to Mike Bloomberg. Mike Bloomberg is an extraordinarily talented businessman.
Yes.
He's been a great public servant. He's been a great businessman, a great philanthropist, one of the best in our country. I think he has a lot of talents. If he chose to get in this race, I think he would be a compelling figure. If he were the nominee of the Democratic Party running against Donald Trump, it would be a tough race for Donald Trump, because Mike Bloomberg has many great features that I think would attract voters to him. Whether he can get the nomination is difficult, because the party's probably moved further to the left than Mike Bloomberg would like, but it's too early to say.
He has reportedly felt that Joe Biden was showing weakness, and that has been the propellant to have him consider getting into the race. What's your thought?
Well, one of my thoughts is, I'm now 70 years old, and nothing makes me feel better when the four potential candidates who could be the Democratic nominee are all older than me, so I don't feel so old. So Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Mike Bloomberg are all older than me, so it makes me feel young. I would say also, for people listening, if you were to go back the last 10 presidential elections, to be very serious, and say, who's the president going to be 1 year out? We're basically 1 year out. You'd be wrong almost every time. You wouldn't have predicted 1 year out Donald Trump, 1 year out Barack Obama, Jimmy Carter, George W. Bush. You wouldn't have predicted that 1 year out. So it's just too hard to say. And I think it's going to be an interesting year, but I don't think anybody can predict where it's going to go yet.
Are you going to be involved in any way?
No, I worked in the Carter administration in the White House. Nobody's asked me to go back in government since. But again, to be serious, I'm the chairman of the Kennedy Center. I'm chairman of the Smithsonian, chairman of the support group for the Library of Congress. I'm chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. I think it's best to do those kind of things in a nonpartisan way. In addition, the program that we're talking about at the Library of Congress, I think if I was an ardent Democrat or an ardent Republican giving a lot of money to either party, I think it might be harder for members to want to come listen to me, host the dinner, and so forth. So I stay out of politics as much as I possibly can.
And will continue to do so.
That's my goal, to stay out.
As far as you can see.
I don't think my contributions one way or the other are going to help anybody that much, and I'm not sure anybody's looking for my support. So I will do the best I can to help my country in other ways.
And you are doing so much in the way of philanthropy as far as our national monuments are concerned. Tell me why you feel so strongly about those.
I came from very modest circumstances. My parents were not college graduates or high school graduates. My father worked in the post office his entire life. I got very lucky, and in a country where you come from modest circumstances with a last name like mine, you might not in other countries have risen up and become successful as I have become. So I feel an obligation to give back to the country. And so I was an original signer of the Giving Pledge. I'm essentially giving away my wealth. And one of the ways I do it is in addition to supporting educational institutions, cultural institutions, and other things relating to scholarships and medical research, those are things that I put a lot of money into. I've tried to do something what I call patriotic philanthropy, which is to remind our fellow citizens of the history of our country, the history and the heritage, the good and the bad. So in that context, I bought historic documents like the Magna Carta and essentially given it to the U.S. government, or preserved documents like the Declaration of Independence or the Emancipation Proclamation, or fixed things like the Washington Monument, Monticello, Montpelier, Arlington House, Lincoln Memorial, and most recently, the Jefferson Memorial. And it's just a way for me to say thank you to the country. It made it possible for me to be successful.
How did you get to be so successful? You didn't see yourself going into moneyed.
Right. When I grew up, I didn't have any money, and my parents didn't really, you know, try to say, you go make a lot of money. In that environment growing up in the 1950s, there weren't billionaires running around. There weren't tech startups. There weren't private equity firms. There weren't hedge funds. So if you were Jewish growing up in a blue-collar family, you would say, maybe you could be a doctor, a dentist, or a lawyer. My mother wanted me to be a dentist. But I didn't want to be a dentist. I told her I might get arthritis in my fingers. I talked her out of that, so I went to law school. But the idea of making a lot of money just did not occur to me. And then what happened was I was practicing law after the Carter White House, and to be honest, I wasn't that great a lawyer. So when you're not that great at something, you have time to think about doing something else. If I was a great lawyer, I'd been too busy to think about doing anything else. I decided to start what was the first private equity firm in Washington, and for a lot of reasons, it took off and became very successful. And that gave me greater wealth than I really had ever aspired to have. And then I decided I would try to give the bulk of it away.
David Rubenstein, I want to thank you for everything you do in the way of your patriotic philanthropy.
Well, thank you, and thank you for reading my book, The American Story. I hope you enjoyed it, and I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Yurev-Livker. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.